Side 9. Bond turned and looked back down the lanes of metal standards, like parking meters, from which speakers could be connected with your car to pick up the sound. As he watched, one or two cars drove in and ranged themselves in the rear rank. Nothing low enough for a Jaguar, but it was dark now, and difficult to see, and he stayed, slewed round in his seat, his eyes on the entrance. An attendant came up. A pretty girl, dressed as a page boy with a tray slung round her neck. "That'll be a dollar," she said, glancing into the car to see there was not a third customer on the floor of the cab. She had pickups coiled over her right arm, and she took one off, plugged it into the nearest standard, and hung the small speaker through the window on Bond's side. The huge man and woman on the screen started talking heatedly. "Coca-Cola, cigarettes, candy?" asked the girl, taking the note Bond handed her. "No, thanks," said Bond. "You're welcome," said the girl, and sauntered off towards the other late arrivals. "Mister, for Christ's sake, will you switch off that crap?" pleaded Ernie Cureo through his teeth. "And keep watching. We'll give him whiles more. Then get him into a dock. Dig out the slug." His voice was weak, and now that the girl had gone, he was half lying with his head against the door. "Won't be long, Ernie. Try and stick it." Bond fiddled with the speaker, found the switch, and silenced the wrangling voices. The huge man on the screen looked as if he was going to hit the woman, and her mouth gaped in a noiseless scream. Bond turned and strained his eyes across the dark expanse behind them. Still nothing. He glanced at the neighboring cars, two faces glued together, a shapeless huddle on a back seat, two prim, rapt, elderly faces staring upwards, the glint of light on an upturned bottle. And then a wave of musky aftershave lotion came up to his nose, and a dark figure rose up from the ground, and a gun was in his face, and a voice on the other side of the car beside Ernie Cureo whispered softly, "Okay, fellas, take it easy." Bond looked into the suety face beside him. The eyes were smiling and cold. The wet lips parted and whispered, "Out, Limey, or your pal's cold turkey. My friend has a silencer. You and we're going for a ride." Bond turned his head and saw the black sausage of metal against the back of Ernie Cureo's neck. He made up his mind. "Okay, Ernie," he said. "Better one than two. I'll go with him. I'll soon be back to get you to the dock. Take care of yourself." "Funny guy," said Suet Face. He opened the door, keeping his gun trained on Bond's face. "Sorry, friend," said Ernie Cureo in a tired voice. "I guess..." But then there was a sharp thud as the gun hit him behind the ear, and he slumped forward and was silent. Bond gritted his teeth and his muscles lumped under his coat. He wondered if he could reach the Beretta. He glanced from one gun to the other, measuring, adding up odds. The four eyes above the two guns were greedy, longing for an excuse to kill him. The two mouths were smiling, wanting him to try something. He felt his blood cooling. He gave it another minute, and then, with his hands in sight, he stepped slowly out of the car with murder tucked away in the back of his mind. "Go ahead to the gate," said Suet Face softly. "Look natural. I got you covered." His gun had disappeared, but his hand was in his pocket. The other man joined them, and his right hand was at the waistband of his trousers. He ranged himself on Bond's other side. The three men walked swiftly towards the entrance, and the moon rising over the mountains straddled their long shadows in front of them across the white, sandy floor. Chapter 19. Spectreville. The red Jaguar was outside the entrance, up against the wall of the enclosure. Bond let them take his gun and climbed in beside the driver. "No funny tricks, if you want to keep your head on straight," said Suet Face, climbing into the rumble seat beside the golf clubs. "There's a gun on you." "Nice little car you once had," said Bond. The shattered windshield had been lowered flat, and a piece of chrome from the radiator stuck up like a pennant between the two wingless front tires. "Where are we going in the remains?" "You'll see," said the driver, a bony man with a cruel mouth and sideburns. He swung the car out onto the road and accelerated back towards the town, and they were soon in amongst the jungle of neon, and then through it and going fast down a two-lane highway that ribboned away across the moonlit desert towards the mountains. There was a big sign which said 95, and Bond remembered what Ernie Cureo had told him, and knew that he was on his way to Spectreville. He hunched down in his seat to protect his eyes from the dust and flies and thought about the immediate future and how to revenge his friend. So these men and the other two in the Chevrolet had been sent to bring him to Mr. Spang. Why had four men been necessary? Surely they were rather a heavyweight answer to Bond's defiance of his orders in the casino. The car lapped up the dead straight road with the needles of the speedometer wavering around 80. The telegraph poles shifted by with the click of a metronome. Bond suddenly felt that he didn't know quite enough of the answers. Was he completely exposed as an enemy of the spangled mob? He could argue himself out of the game of roulette on the grounds that he hadn't understood his orders. And if he had been a bit troublesome when the four men came for him, he could at least pretend that he had thought it was a tale from a rival mob. "If you wanted me, why didn't you just call me in my room?" Bond could hear himself saying in an injured tone of voice. At least he had shown that he was tough enough for any job Mr. Spang might offer him. And in any case, Bond reassured himself, he was just about to achieve his main objective, to get to the end of the pipeline and somehow link Serafimo Spang with his brother in London. Bond crouched, his eyes on the luminous dials in front of him, and concentrated on the interview ahead and on wondering how much evidence about the pipeline he could possibly extract from it. Later, he thought about Ernie Cureo and the revenge he owed him. It was not in his makeup to worry about how he himself was going to get away once he had achieved these two objectives. His own safety gave him no concern. He still had no respect for these people, only contempt and dislike. Bond was still rehearsing imaginary conversations with Mr. Spang when, after 2 hours' driving, he felt the speed of the car coming down. He lifted his head above the dashboard. They were coasting up to a section of high wire fence with a gate in it, and a big notice lit up by their single spotlight. It said, "Spectreville, City Limits, Do Not Enter, Dangerous Dogs." The car drew up behind the notice and beside an iron post embedded in concrete. On the post there was a bell push and a small iron grill, and written in red, "Ring and state your business." Without leaving the wheel, Sideburns reached out and pressed the button. There was a pause, and then a metallic voice said, "Yes." "Brasso and McGonagall," said the driver, loudly. "Okay," said the voice. There was a sharp click. The high wire gate slowly opened. They drove through and over an iron strip in the narrow dirt road beyond. Bond looked back over his shoulder and saw the gate close behind them. He also noticed with pleasure that the face of, presumably, McGonagall was plastered with dust and the blood of dead flies. The dirt road continued for about a mile across the brutal, stony surface of the desert, in which an occasional clump of gesticulating cactus was the only vegetation. Then there was a glow ahead, and they rounded a spur of mountain and went down a hill and into a brightly lit, straggling assembly of about 20 buildings. Beyond, the moon glinted on a single railway track, which lanced off, straight as a die, towards the distant horizon. They drew up among the grey clapboard houses and shops marked Drugs, Barber, Farmer's Bank and Wells Fargo, under a hissing gaslight outside a two-story building which said in faded gold, "Pink Garter Saloon," and underneath, "Beers and Wines." From behind the traditional sawn-off swing doors, yellow light streamed out onto the street and onto the sleek black and silver of a 1920s Stutz Bearcat roadster at the curb. There was the sweet nasal twang of a honky-tonk piano playing "I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now," slightly flat. The music reminded Bond of sawdust floors, nursed drinks, and girls' legs in the widest mesh stockings. The whole scene was like something out of an exceptionally well-mounted western. "Out, Limey," said the driver. The three men climbed stiffly out of the car and onto the raised wooden sidewalk. Bond bent to massage a leg that had gone to sleep, watching the feet of the two men. "Come on, sissy," said McGonagall, giving him a nudge with his loosely held gun. Bond slowly straightened himself, measuring inches. He limped heavily as he followed the man to the door of the saloon. He paused as the swing doors flapped back into his face. He felt the prod of Frasso's gun from behind. Now! Bond straightened himself and leapt through the still swinging door. McGonagall's back was just in front of him, and beyond, there was a brightly lit, empty bar room in which an automatic piano was playing to itself. Bond's hands shot out and caught the man above the elbows. He lifted him off his feet and swung him round and into the swing doors and into Frasso, who was halfway through them. The whole clapboard house trembled as the two bodies met, and Frasso fell back through the doors and crashed onto the sidewalk. McGonagall catapulted back and twisted to face Bond. There was a rising gun in his hand. Bond's left caught him on the shoulder. At the same time, his open right hand slapped down hard on the gun. McGonagall went back on his heels against the door jamb. The gun clattered to the floor. The snout of Frasso's revolver appeared through the swing doors. It weaved quickly round towards Bond like an aiming snake. As its blue and yellow tongue licked out, Bond, his blood singing with the battle, dived for the ground and for the gun at McGonagall's feet. He got his hand on it and fired two quick shots upwards from the floor before McGonagall stamped on his firing hand and landed on top of him. As Bond went down, he caught a glimpse of Frasso's gun arced up between the swing doors, pumping bullets into the ceiling, and this time the crash of the body on the planking outside sounded final. Then McGonagall's hands were at him, and Bond was kneeling on the ground with his head down, trying to protect his eyes. The gun was still in the floor, within reach of the first free hand. For seconds they fought, silently, like animals, and then Bond got to one knee and gave a great heave of his shoulders and lashed upwards at the glimpse of a face, and the weight came off him, and he rose to a crouch. As he did so, McGonagall's knee came up like a piston under Bond's chin and knocked him to his feet with a snap of the teeth that shook his skull. Bond had no time to clear his head before the gangster gave a thick grunt and came for him, head downwards, with both arms flailing. Bond twisted to protect his stomach, and the gangster's head hit him in the ribs, and the two fists crashed into his body. Bond's breath whistled through his teeth with the pain, but he kept focus on McGonagall's head below him, and with a twist of the body that put all his shoulder behind his hand, he whipped in a hard left, and as the gangster's head came up, he lashed out with his right to the chin. The impact of the two blows straightened McGonagall and rocked him back on his feet. Bond was on him like a panther, crowding him and raining in blows to the body until the gangster began to sag. Bond grabbed at one weaving wrist and dived for an ankle and yanked it away from the floor. Then he put out all his strength, made almost a full turn to gather momentum, and slung the body sideways into the room. There was a first twanging crash as the flying figure hit the upright pianola. And then, with an explosion of metallic discords and breaking wood, the dying instrument toppled over, and, with McGonagall spread-eagled across it, thundered to the floor. Amidst the diminishing crescendo of echoes, Bond stood in the center of the room, his legs braced with the last effort, and the breath rasping in his throat. Slowly, he lifted one bruised hand and ran it through his dripping hair. Cut. It was a girl's voice, and it came from the direction of the bar. Bond shook himself and turned slowly round. Four people had come into the saloon. They were standing in line with their backs to the mahogany and brass bar, behind which ranks of gleaming bottles rose to the ceiling. Bond had no idea how long they had been there. A step in front of the other three stood the leading citizen of Spectreville, resplendent, motionless, dominant. Mr. Spang was dressed in full Western costume down to the long silver spurs on his polished black boots. The costume and the broad leather chaps that covered his legs were in black, picked out and embellished with silver. The big, quiet hands rested on the ivory butts of two long-barreled revolvers which protruded from a holster down each thigh, and the broad black belt from which they hung was ribbed with ammunition. Mr. Spang should have looked ridiculous, but he didn't. His big head was thrust slightly forward, and his eyes were cold, fierce slits. On Mr. Spang's right, with her hands on her hips, was Tiffany Case. In a Western dress of white and gold, she looked like something out of Annie Get Your Gun. She stood and watched Bond. Her eyes were shining. Her full red lips were slightly parted, and she was panting, as if she had been kissed. The other half of the quartet was the two men in black hoods from Saratoga. Each of them held a .38, police positive, trained on Bond's heaving stomach. Bond slowly took out a handkerchief and wiped his face with it. He was feeling light-headed, and the scene in the brilliantly lit saloon, with its brass fittings and its homely advertisements for long-vanished beers and whiskies, was suddenly macabre. Mr. Spang broke the silence. "Bring him over." The hard jaws that operated the sharp, thin lips separated and cut off each word as cleanly as a meat slice. "And tell someone to call Detroit. And tell the boys they're suffering from delusions of adequacy up there. And tell them to send down two more. And tell them they got to be better than the last lot. And tell someone else to clean up this mess, okay?" There was a faint jingle of spurs on the wooden floor as Mr. Spang left the room. With a last look at Bond, a look that held some message that was more than the obvious warning, the girl followed him. The two men came up to Bond, and the big one said, "You heard." Bond walked slowly after the girl, and the two men lined up behind him. There was a door behind the bar. Bond pushed through it and found himself in a station waiting room with benches and old-fashioned notices about trains and warning you not to spit on the floor. "Right," said one of the men, and Bond turned through a sawn-off swing door and onto a plank station platform. And then Bond stopped in his tracks and hardly noticed a sharp prod in the ribs from a gun barrel. It was probably the most beautiful train in the world. The engine was one of the old locomotives of the Highland Light class of around 1870, which Bond had heard called the handsomest steam locomotives ever built. Its polished brass handrails and the fluted sand dome and heavy warning bell above the long, gleaming barrel of the boiler glittered under the hissing gas lights of the station. A wisp of steam came from the towering balloon smokestack of the old wood burner. The great sweeping cowcatcher was topped by three massive brass lights, a bulging pilot beam at the base of the smokestack, and two storm lanterns below. Above the two tall driving wheels and fine early Victorian gold capitals was written "The Cannonball," and the name was repeated along the side of the black and gold painted tender piled with birch logs behind the tall, square driver's cabin. Coupled to the tender was a maroon-coloured state Pullman. Its arched windows above the narrow mahogany panels were picked out in cream. An oval plaque amidships said, "The Sierra Belle." Above the windows and below the slightly jutting barrel roof, "Tonopah Tidewater RR" was written in cream capitals on dark blue.
"Guess you never seen nothing like that, Limey," said one of the guards proudly. "Now get going."
His voice was muffled by the black silk hood. Bond walked slowly across and stepped up to the brass-railed observation platform with the shining brakeman's wheel in the center. For the first time in his life, he saw the point of being a millionaire, and suddenly, and also for the first time, he thought that there might be more to this man Spang than he had reckoned with. The interior of the Pullman glittered with Victorian luxury. The light from small crystal chandeliers in the roof shone back from polished mahogany walls and winked off silver fittings and cut-glass vases and lampstands. The carpets and swagged curtains were wine red, and the domed ceiling, broken at intervals by oval-framed paintings of garlanded cherubs and wreathed flowers against a background of sky and clouds, was cream, as were the slats of the drawn Venetian blinds. First came a small dining room, with the remains of a supper for two, a basket of fruit and an open bottle of champagne in a silver bucket, and then a narrow corridor from which three doors led, Bond assumed, to the bedrooms and lavatory. Bond was still thinking about this arrangement as, with the guards at his heels, he pushed open the door into the stateroom. At the far end of the stateroom, with his back to a small open fireplace, flanked by bookshelves gleaming richly with gold-tooled leather bindings, stood Mr. Spang. In a red leather armchair near a small writing desk halfway down the car, Tiffany Case sat bolt upright. Bond didn't care for the way she was holding her cigarette. It was nervous and artificial. It looked frightened. Bond took a few steps down the car to a comfortable chair. He turned it round to face them both, and sat down and crossed one knee over the other. He took out a cigarette case and lit a cigarette, and swallowed a deep lungful of smoke, and let the smoke come out between his teeth with a long, relaxed hiss. Mr. Spang had an unlighted cigar jutting from the exact center of his mouth. He took it out.
Stay here, Winth. Kid, get along and do what I said. The strong teeth bit the words off like inches of celery. Now, you. His eyes glittered angrily at Bond. Who are you, and what's going on?
I shall need a drink if we're going to talk, said Bond.
Mr. Spang eyed him coldly. Get him a drink, Wint. Bond half turned his head.
A bourbon and branch water, he said. Half and half.
There was an angry grunt, and Bond heard the woodwork creak as the heavy man walked back down the Pullman. Bond didn't much like Mr. Spang's question. He went back over his story. It still looked all right. He sat and smoked and looked at Mr. Spang, weighing him up. The drink came, and the guard thrust it into his hand so that some of it slopped onto the carpet.
Thank you, Wint, said Bond.
He took a deep swallow. It was strong and good. He took another. Then he put the glass down on the floor beside him. He looked up again into the tense, hard face.
I just don't like being lent on, he said easily. I did my job and got paid. If I chose to gamble with the money, that was my affair. I could have lost. And then a lot of your men started breathing down my neck, and I got impatient. If you wanted to talk to me, why didn't you just call me on the telephone? Putting that tail on was unfriendly, and when they got rude and started shooting, I thought it was time to do some leaning of my own.
The black and white face against the colored books didn't yield.
You don't get the message, fella, Mr. Spang said softly. Maybe I better bring you up to date. Got a coded signal yesterday from London.
His hand went to the breast pocket of his black western shirt, and he slowly pulled out a piece of paper, holding Bond's eyes with his. Bond knew the piece of paper was bad news, really bad news, just as surely as you do when you read the word deeply at the beginning of a telegram. This is from a good friend in London, said Mr. Spang. He slowly released Bond's eyes and looked down at the piece of paper. It says, reliably informed, Peter Franks held by police on unspecified charge. Endeavor at all costs, hold substitute carrier. Ascertain if operations endangered. Eliminate him and report. There was silence in the car. Mr. Spang's eyes rose from the paper and glittered redly down on Bond.
Well, Mr. Hooses, this looks like a good year for something horrible to happen to you.
Bond knew he was for it, and part of his mind slowly digested the knowledge, wondering how it was going to be done. But at the same time, another part of him told him that he had discovered what he wanted to know, what he had come to America to find out. The two Spangs did represent the beginning and the end of the diamond pipeline. At this moment, he had completed the job he had set out to do. He knew the answers. Now, somehow, he must get the answers back to M. Bond reached down for his drink. The ice rattled hollowly as he took the last deep swallow and put the glass down. He looked candidly up at Mr. Spang.
I took the job from Peter Franks. He didn't like the look of it, and I needed the money.
Don't give me that crap, said Mr. Spang flatly. You're a cop or a private eye of some sort, and I'm going to find out who you are and who you work for and what you know. What you were doing in the Acme Baths alongside that crooked jock. Why you carry a gun and where you learned to handle it. How come you're tied in with Pinkertons in the shape of that phony cab driver? Things like that. You look like an eye, and you behave like one. And, he turned with sudden anger on Tiffany Case,
how you fell for him, you silly bitch, I just can't figure. The hell you can't,
flared Tiffany Case. I get handed the guy by ABC and he acts okay. You think maybe I should have told ABC to try again. Not me, brother. I know my place in this outfit. I don't think you could push me around. And for all you know, this guy may be telling the truth.
Her angry eyes swept over Bond, and he caught the glint of fear for him, behind them.
Well, we're going to find out, said Mr. Spang, and go on finding out until the guy croaks, and if he thinks he can take it, he's got another think coming.
He looked over Bond's head at the guard.
Wint, get Kid, and come back with the boots.
The boots.
Bond sat silent, gathering his strength and his courage. It would be a waste of time to argue with Mr. Spang or to try to escape 50 miles out in the desert. He had got out of worse jams, so long as they didn't intend to kill him yet. So long as he gave nothing away. There was Ernie Correo, and there was Felix Leiter. There might just possibly be Tiffany Case. He looked across at her. Her head was bent. She was looking carefully at her fingernails. Bond heard the two guards come up behind him.
"Take him out on the platform," said Mr. Spang.
Bond saw the corner of his tongue come out and slightly touch the thin lips. "Brooklyn's stomping. 80%er. Okay?"
"Okay, boss."
It was the voice belonging to Wint. It sounded greedy. The two hooded men came up and sat down side by side on a dark red chaise longue that ran down the car opposite Bond. They put football boots down on the thick carpet beside them and started to unlace their shoes.
Chapter 20. Flames coming out of the top. The black frogman suit fitted tightly. It hurt everywhere. Why the hell hadn't Strangways made certain the Admiralty got his measurements right? And it was very dark under the sea, and the currents were strong, pulling him against the coral. He would have to swim hard against them. But now something had got him by the arm. What the hell?
"James. For Christ's sake, James."
She took her mouth away from his ear. This time she pinched the naked, blood-stained arm as hard as she could, and at last Bond's eyes opened between their puffed lids, and he looked up at her from the wooden floor and gave a shuddering sigh. She tugged at him, terrified that he would slip away from her again. He seemed to understand, and he rolled over and struggled onto hands and knees, his head hanging down towards the ground like a wounded animal.
"Can you walk?"
"Wait."
The thick whisper coming through the cracked lips sounded strange to him. Perhaps she hadn't understood.
"Wait,"
he said again, and his mind started exploring his body to see what was left of it. He could feel his feet and his hands. He could move his head from side to side. He could see the bars of moonlight on the floor. He had been able to hear her. It ought to be all right, but he just didn't want to move. His willpower was gone. He just wanted to sleep. Or even to die, anything to lessen the pain that was in him and all over him, stabbing, hammering, grinding him, and to kill the memory of the four boots thudding into him and the grunts coming from the two hooded figures. Directly he thought of the two men and of Mr. Spang. The will to live came into Bond in a flood, and he said,
"Okay."
And then again,
"Okay."
So that she would be sure to understand.
"We're in the waiting room," whispered the girl. "We must get to the end of the station. Left, outside the door. Do you hear me, James?"
She reached out and brushed the damp, sticky hair away from his forehead.
"I have to crawl," said Bond.
"Follow you."
The girl got to her feet and pushed open the door. Bond gritted his teeth and crawled out onto the moonlit platform, and when he saw the dark patch on the ground, rage and revenge gave him strength, and he got clumsily to his feet, shaking his head to keep the red-black waves from drowning him, and with Tiffany Case's arm round him, he limped along the wooden boards to where they sloped down towards the ground beside the gleaming rails. And there, in the single-line siding, was a railroad handcar. Bond stopped and gazed at it.
"Petrol,"
he said vaguely. Tiffany Case gestured towards a row of cans against the station wall.
"Just filled her up," she whispered back. "It's what they use for inspecting the line. And I can work it. And I shifted the points. Hurry, get aboard,"
she giggled breathlessly.
"Next stop, Rhyolite."
"My God, you're a girl," whispered Bond. "But there'll be a hell of a noise when we start that thing. Wait, got an idea. Got some matches."
Half his pain had fallen away from him. The breath came fast through his teeth as he turned away from her and focused on the silent, tinder-dry buildings. She was wearing slacks and a shirt. She dug into the pocket of the slacks and handed him her lighter.
"What's the idea?" she said. "We ought to be moving."
But Bond lurched over to the row of petrol tins and started opening them and hurling the contents over the wooden walls and platform. When he had emptied half a dozen cans, he went back to her.
"Get her going.
He bent agonizingly down and picked up a crumpled newspaper from beside the rails. There was the angry whine of the self-starter, and then the little two-stroke engine caught and started hammering busily. Bond flicked the lighter. The piece of paper flared, and he flung it away from him amongst the petrol cans. The whoosh of flame almost caught him as he threw himself backwards onto the little platform of the car. But then the girl let in the clutch, and the handcar started down the line. There was a rattle and a sickening lurch at the points, and then they were out on the main line, and the speedometer was trembling at 30, and the girl's hair was flowing back like a golden banner towards him. Bond turned to look back at the great bloom of flame they had left behind them. He could almost hear the dry boards crackling and the shouts of the sleepers as they dashed from their rooms. If only it would get Wint and Kidd and catch the paint on the Pullman and fire the wood in the tender of the cannonball and finish off the gangster's box of toys. But he and the girl had their own problems. What time was it? Bond gulped down the cool night air and tried to get his mind to work again. The moon was low. 4 o'clock. Bond hunched his way painfully up the platform to the two bucket seats and somehow scrambled over and got down beside the girl. He put an arm round her shoulders, and she turned and smiled into his eyes. She raised her voice above the noise of the engine and the hammer of the iron wheels on the rails. "That was quite an exit, like something out of an old Buster Keaton film. How'd you feel?" She surveyed the battered face. "You looked terrible." "Nothing broken," said Bond. "Suppose that's what's meant by an 80%er." He grinned painfully. "It's better being kicked than being shot." The girl's face cringed. "I just had to sit there and pretend that I didn't care. Spang stayed and listened and watched me. Then they checked up on the ropes and slung you into the waiting room, and everyone went happily to bed. I waited an hour in my room, and then I got busy. The worst part was trying to wake you up." Bond tightened his arm round her shoulders. "I'll tell you what I think of you when it doesn't hurt so much. But what about you, Tiffany? You'll be in a jam if they catch up with us. And who are those two men in the hoods, Wint and Kidd? What are they going to do about all this? I wouldn't mind seeing a little more of those two." The girl glanced sideways at the grim curl of the bruised lips. "Never seen them without those hoods on," she said truthfully. "They're supposed to be from Detroit, strictly bad news. They do the strong-arm work and special undercover jobs. They'll all be after us now, but don't you worry about me." She looked up at him again, and her eyes were shining and happy. "First thing is to get this crate to Rhyolite. Then we'll have to find a car somewhere and get over the state border into California. I've got plenty of money. Then we'll get you to a doctor and buy you a bath and a shirt and think again. I got your gun. One of the helps brought it over when they'd finished picking up the pieces of those two guys you wrestled with in the Pink Garter. I collected it after Spang had gone to bed." She unbuttoned her shirt and dug into the waistband of her slacks. Bond took the Beretta, feeling the warmth of her on the metal. He flicked out the magazine, 3 rounds left, and 1 in the breech. He replaced the magazine, put the gun on safe, and tucked it into the top of his trousers. For the first time, he realized that his coat was gone. One of his shirt sleeves hung in tatters. He tore it off and threw it away. He felt for the cigarette case in his right-hand hip pocket. It was gone, but in the left-hand pocket there was still his passport and note case. He pulled them out. By the light of the moon, he could see they were cracked and dented. He felt for his money in the note case. It was still there. He put the things back in his pocket. For a while they drove on, with only the purr of the little engine and the clickety-click of the wheels to break the looming silence of the night. For as far as they could see, the thin silver line of the rails spun on towards the horizon with only an occasional break, marked by a points lever, where a rusty branch line curved off into the dark mass of the Spectre Mountains on their right. To the left, there was nothing except the endless floor of the desert on which the hint of dawn was beginning to edge the writhing cactus clumps with blue, and 2 miles away, the gunmetal shimmer of the moon on Highway 95. The handcar sang happily on down the rails. There were no controls to bother with except a brake lever and a kind of joystick with a twist-grip accelerator, which the girl held fully open with the speedometer steady at 30. And the miles and the minutes clicked by, and every now and then Bond turned painfully in his seat and inspected the blossoming red glow in the sky behind them. They had been going nearly an hour, when a thin, humming undertone in the air or on the rails made Bond stiffen. Again he looked back over his shoulder. Was there a tiny glowworm glimmer between them and the false red dawn of the burning ghost town? Bond's scalp tingled.
Do you see anything back there?
She turned her head.
Then, without replying, she slowed the engine down so that they were coasting quietly.
They both listened. Yes, it was in the rails, a soft, quivering, not more than a distant sigh.
It's the cannonball, said Tiffany flatly. She gave a sharp twist to the accelerator and the handcar sped on again.
What can she do? Asked Bond.
Maybe 60.
How far to Rhyolite?
Around 30.
Bond worked on the figures for a moment in silence. It's going to be a near thing. Can't tell how far away he is. Can you get anything more out of this?
Not a scrap, she said grimly, even if my name was Casey Jones instead of Case.
We'll be all right, said Bond. You keep her rolling. Maybe he'll blow up or something.
Oh, sure, she said. Or maybe the spring will run down and he's left the key of his engine at home in his pants pocket.
For 15 minutes they sped along in silence, and now Bond could clearly see the great pilot light of the engine cutting through the night, not more than 5 miles away, and an angry fountain above it from the wood sparks flaming out of the great dome of the smokestack. The rails were trembling beneath them, and what had been a distant sigh was now a low, threatening murmur.
Perhaps he'll run out of wood, thought Bond. On an impulse, he said casually to the girl, I suppose we're all right for gas.
Oh, sure, said Tiffany. Put in a whole can. There's no indicator, but these things will run forever on a gallon of gas.
Almost before the words were out of her mouth, as if to comment on them, the little engine gave a deprecating cough.
Put, put, put. Then it ran merrily on. Christ, said Tiffany. Do you hear that?
Bond said nothing. He felt the palms of his hands go wet.
And again, put, put, put. Tiffany Case gingerly nursed the accelerator.
Oh, dear little engine, she said plaintively. Beautiful, clever little engine, please be kind.
Put, 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 hiss, put, hiss, and suddenly they were freewheeling along in silence. 25, said the speedometer. 20, 15, 10, 5. A last savage twist of the accelerator and a kick from Tiffany Case at the engine housing, and they had stopped.
Christ, said Bond, once. He got painfully out on the side of the track and limped to the petrol tank at the rear, pulling his blood-stained handkerchief out of his trouser pocket. He unscrewed the filler cap and lowered the handkerchief down so that it reached the bottom of the tank. He pulled it out and felt it and sniffed it, dry as a bone.
That's that, he said to the girl. Now just let's think hard. He looked all round. No cover to the left, and 2 miles at least to the road. On the right, the mountains, perhaps a quarter of a mile away. They might get there and hide up, but for how long? It looked the best chance. The ground beneath his feet was shaking. He looked down the line at the glaring, implacable eye. How far? 2 miles. Would Spang see the handcar in time? Would he be able to stop? Might he be derailed? But then Bond remembered the great jutting cowcatcher that would sweep the light car out of the way like a bale of straw.
Come on, Tiffany, he called. We've got to take to the hills.
Where was she? He limped round the car. She was running back down the track in front. She came up, panting.
There's a branch line just ahead, she gasped. If we can push the thing there and you can work the old points, he might miss us.
My God, said Bond slowly. Then, with awe in his voice, there's something better than that.
Give me a hand. And he bent down and gritted his teeth against the pane and started pushing.
Once started, the car moved easily, and they only had to follow behind it and keep it rolling. They came to the points, and Bond went on pushing until they were 20 yards past.
What the hell? Panted Tiffany.
Come on, said Bond, half stumbling, half running back to where the rusty switch stuck up beside the rails.
We're going to put the cannonball onto the branch line.
Oh, boy, said Tiffany Case reverently. And then they were both at the switch, and Bond's bruised muscles were cracking as he heaved.
Slowly the rusty metal shifted in the bed where it had lain unmoved for 50 years, and millimeter by millimeter the rails showed a crack and then a widening gap as Bond strained and jerked at the lever. And then it was done. and Bond knelt on the ground with his head down, fighting the dizziness that threatened to drown him. But then there was a glare of light on the ground, and Tiffany tugged at him, and he was on his feet again and stumbling back to the car, and the whole air was full of thunder and the doleful clanging of the warning bell as the great flaming iron beast came roaring towards them. "Get down and don't move!" shouted Bond above the noise, and he thrust her to the ground behind the flimsy shelter of the handcar. Then he limped quickly to the side of the track and drew his gun and stood sideways on with his pistol arm up like a duelist and squinted back up the track into the great onrushing eye below the volcano of swirling fire and smoke. God, what a monster! Could it possibly take the curve? Wouldn't it just hurtle onto them and smash them to pulp? On it came. Flip! Something whipped into the ground beside him, and there was a pinpoint flash from the cabin. Boing! There was another flash, and the bullet hit the rail and whined off into the night. Crack! 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 Now he could hear the gun above the roar of the engine. Something sang sharply in his ear. I left my heart. Bond held his fire. Only four bullets, and he knew when they would go. And then, 20 yards away, the flying engine thundered into the curve and took the siding with a lurch that sent logs hurtling towards Bond off the top of the tender. There was a shrill scream of metal as the flanges on the 6-foot-tall driving wheels ground into the bend, a swift impression of smoke and flame and pounding machinery, and then a glimpse into the cabin and of the black and silver figure of Spang, spread-eagled, clinging to the side of the cabin with one hand, and with the other hand outflung to the long iron handle of the throttle lever. Bond's gun shouted its four words. There was a lightning impression of a white face jerked up towards the sky, and then the great black and gold engine was passed and hurtling towards the shadowy wall of the Spectre Mountains, the beam of its pilot light scything at the darkness ahead and its automatic warning bell clanging sadly on. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. Bond slowly tucked the Beretta into his trousers and stood looking after the coffin of Mr. Spang. And the trail of smoke drifted over his head, and for a moment put out the moon. Tiffany Case came running to him, and they stood side by side and watched the flaming banner from the tall smokestack, and listened to the mountains throw back the echo of the charging locomotive. The girl clutched his arm as the engine gave a sudden swerve and vanished behind a spur of rock. And now there was only a faraway drumming in the mountains, and a red glow that flickered off the crags as the cannonball tore on down the cutting into the belly of the rock. And suddenly there was a great tongue of fire, and a terrible iron crash as if a battleship had run on a reef, and then a muffled clanging that seemed to come from under their feet, and finally a deep, distant boom from the bowels of the earth, and a barrage of miscellaneous echoes. And then, with the noise gone, a steady, singing silence. Bond heaved a deep sigh as if he was just waking up. So that was the end of one of the Spangs, of one of the brutal, theatrical, overblown, dead-end adults who made up the Spangled mob. He had been a stage gangster, surrounded with stage properties, but that didn't alter the fact that he had intended to kill Bond. "Let's get away from here," Tiffany Case said urgently. "I've had enough of this." Bond felt the pain creeping back into his body as his tension relaxed. "Yes," he said shortly. He was glad to turn his back on the memory of the upturned white face and the beautiful black charging engine. He felt light-headed. He wondered if he would make it. "We'll have to get to the road. It'll be hard going. Come on." It took them an hour and a half to cover the 2 miles. And by the time he collapsed in the dirt beside the cement highway, Bond was delirious. It was the girl who had got him there. But for her, he would never have kept a straight course. He would have stumbled about amongst the cactus and rock and mica until his strength was exhausted and the broiling sun came to finish the job. And now she was cradling his head against her and talking softly to him and wiping the sweat off his face with the corner of her shirt. And every now and then she paused to look up and down the dead straight concrete road whose horizons were already shimmering in the heat waves of early morning. An hour later, she jumped to her feet and tucked in her shirt and went and stood in the middle of the road. A low black car was coming out of the dancing haze which hid the distant valley of Las Vegas. It rolled to a stop just in front of her, and a hawk-like face under an untidy mop of straw-colored hair stuck itself out of the window. Q keen grey eyes briefly looked her over. They glanced at the prostrate figure of the man in the dust beside the road and came back to her. Then, in a friendly Texan drawl, the driver said, "Felix Leiter, ma'am, at your service. And what may I do for you this beautiful morning?" End of side 9.